The theme for the afternoon talk with you is emptiness and the nature of self. And in the talk with you, what I would like to do is to explore these two vitally important areas. They're quite essential for any deep and profound understanding of the Dharma. And I should state just initially with regard to this, in a way it's a lifelong meditation upon. You'll have to get closer if you... And the exploration of the Dharma at some point, and that may happen through some deliberate intentionality, it may happen quite spontaneously, but at some point, this key thread and theme of emptiness has to be explored from a human standpoint. What does it mean? And quite often, when initially we hear this a concept, because we often associate it in a kind of negative way, when we're feeling a bit low, I feel really empty inside, things like that, when we're feeling a generalized philosophical view, or life is so empty, or whatever, then that the word then gets used with a reactive feeling and a reactive view. It doesn't carry any of that, but understandably, in our language and culture, it easily does. And what I'd like to do is just take from some small and specifics in life, look at the nature of self and images that take place. Look at what is this idea of self in the deeper sense of the Dharma, and hopefully some meeting points. It may require, of course, and probably will, much more reflection from us, much more contemplation and inquiry. But there's something very precious and beautiful about this. And just personally, today in one of the small groups, we're touching a little bit on image, on archetypes. And these, for human beings, are very, very powerful. And what I mean by that it's not unusual for us, in our connection or in our relationship or meeting with the other, whoever she or he may be, that we have a picture, an image of who this person, a certain kind of identity, very, very quickly arises. And it's hard to see, so to speak, through the identity, through the person, to the person, and deeper than that. And a very good illustration of this arose, and some of you probably can connect with this, that my Gwenwyn, my daughter's mother, who lives about 10 minutes walk away, she made very good friends with one of the women in the town. And the woman in the town is married to the local physician, the local doctor. And so, both having children, the doctor's wife would come round and visit Gwenwyn, and sometimes the doctor would come to the house and drop off the children or pick them up or have a cup of tea, whatever. And Gwenwyn said to me, it was impossible, over the words I remember, to see just the father, just the husband. All she could see was the doctor was visiting the house. I mean, he wasn't carrying his bag, you know, he didn't have a stethoscope or a white coat on. You know, he would just come in trousers and a t-shirt, but the doctor, you know, and thought, we're all well. And the archetype of the image was so strong that it was very difficult for her to see further. Yet there was no outer signal, you know, from the appearance there. And let's use it as a small example in life. And this happens sometimes when people meet so-called famous people or whatever. They start feeling very nervous. and excited and saying the most silly little things pouring out of their mouth because they're completely in awe of somebody who's very good at playing somebody who they're not. And we're so impressed with this. So there's the image, the picture. And we say, looking at it more carefully, it's a mental construct. It carries with it an idea, a view, and feelings and thoughts, and especially memory of thought as well. And it's not easy. And of course, in the role of Dharma teachers, of course, another archetype as well. And some of the Dharma teachers, when I've traveled, have said sometimes when they began sharing the Dharma with others, and some of you will know that in any area or field where you've come into some authority, that how quickly the perception of others changes, and the relationship changes, and the attitude changes, yet the person hasn't really changed, they've just added, you know, some kind of role or a function which goes on. So just using this as a small example, or examples, of how in this world that we live in, we are bewitched, we are sometimes spellbound, starstruck, or whatever it might be, by a picture, by a story, by an archetype, and there are many different kinds of them. And Dharma practice is not to rubbish them or put them down, but to acknowledge that they, one of the key concepts here, is dependently arising. It's dependently arising on the, in this case, on the role. It's dependently arising on the picture image that one has. And in that meeting of the two, in this case, the person seems to be this. This is the doctor. This is the teacher. This is the pop star or whatever. And in all of that is a kind of collusion. But the collusion of events is empty of any substance. There is nothing in the person of any substance which says, this is who I am. And I remember when I was a monk, the Dalai Lama came to pay respect to my teacher, Ajahn Buddhadas, in the south of Thailand. This is, must be 45 years ago, and I was in the forest. And Ajahn Buddhadas, he invited the Dalai Lama to give a talk to the monks. The Dalai Lama sat in front of us. The teachings were given in the forest, in a particular area in the forest. And the Dalai Lama asked a very valid question. Who is the Dalai Lama? Who is the Dalai Lama? And he said, is it the robes that is the Dalai Lama? No. The monks, we were wearing our robes. Is the voice the Dalai Lama? Is the tone the Dalai Lama? Can you find the Dalai Lama anywhere? And you can't. So there's a kind of agreement that takes place, of formations, the word samkara, some of you will know, comes together, and these formations in the dynamics of life can be strongly influential on feelings, on thoughts, on memory, and what we say, and how we do. And important aspect I'm trying to get across here is how easily this is viewed as the self of the other, or sometimes the self of myself. And then in comes the I am, whatever, I am a Dharma teacher, what else am I? English, God forbid, and whatever, I am a man, and I am living my life, and I am this. And all of this gives the feeling, through a boring amount of repetition, it gives the feeling I am. And this feeling of I am gives a feeling of self. So the self forms together and it says, I am here. This is my reality. And then the self looks outside and says, you are there. That's yourself out there. This is myself here. That's yourself there. And there are lots of selves around there. And this is the reality. And we have persuaded each other. That's the truth. With a kind of obedience, which is alarming. So in the looking, in the relationship to the way we look at the world and look at ourselves, sometimes we are spellbound, and I mean that, spellbound by what reveals itself as if it's the truth of things. As if it's the truth of things. And as I mentioned in the opening talk with you the other day, Dharma wants us to go much, much deeper than that. And sometimes, as I say, we, in these pictures and images, and I think if I've got my big glasses here, before I go on, I want to get these Polish mothers out of the way. So some of them, and I've forgive me for polishing the English, or should I say polishing the English. A Polish mother telephones her children every day and tells them how much she has sacrificed all her life. A Polish mother tells her children as often as she can, you are not grateful for all I've done for you. A Polish mother tells everybody that her children are the most beautiful and the most talented, and then she sees her children and blames them for everything. A Polish mother says, you are so thin. You're not eating enough. You have to eat more. The Polish mother says, I am ill, ill, ill. I am dying, dying, dying. And then she says, why didn't somebody tell me that my husband has left me? A Polish mother says, do you want me to have a heart attack? Or the Polish mother says, do you want your father to have a heart attack? Polish mother says, I'm hungry. When will you eat supper? And one says, there's a beautiful sunset outside. I'll just go out for a few minutes, and then afterwards I eat. All right, I'll eat alone. What is the difference between a Doberman, you know, Doberman, these huge, ferocious dogs, you know, you see them in horror films. What is the difference between a Doberman and a Polish mother? The Doberman eventually lets go. I thought it was brilliant. Like a woman in the United States, she said, I haven't spoken to my mother for 6 weeks. I don't like to interrupt. All right, enough. Images, stereotypes, what to do with them. All right. So sometimes they look and say, okay, I want to look deeper. I don't want to be so spellbound by my pictures. by myself other pictures and stories, that those presentations there, and the word presentation is rather a key one here. What happened to us with life is that there are constant presentations going on. And in any moment, in any situation, the variables on what is presented are enormous. They are so enormous that they're actually infinite in number. We couldn't set a limit, so that anything that you and I turn our attention to, as it were, the subject engaged in the world, as one example, that anything which you and I turn our attention to, with our eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and touch, both in what we turn our attention to and the way that we turn our attention to, the variables are immense. Immense. You and I could sit here in this moment, just one person, and say, well, what the presentable of this moment, in the most simple, we could say, is a group of people being together. That's the presentable. But a little observation, and we could see much, much more. Just through the small vehicle of the eyes, we could say, well, this is going on in the room, and that is going on in the room, and this is happening, and that is happening. And then we open up the ears, and that's happening, and open up. So the variations there, and the variations of what is being presented, are multiple. They're incredibly diverse. And it's not surprising that you and I, in relationship to anything, including ourselves, including so-called others, that the interpretation, the view, the analysis, the feeling about, the thoughts about, the observations of what it is, what it isn't, is multiple. And therefore, there is no such thing as the one. There is no such view which you and I could boil everything down to and say, well, that's the true view. That's the true way of looking. That's the only way of looking. Because any of us who came to that single view, this is the only way of looking, would immediately find, if one is honest, differences of view from within, and immediately find differences of view from without. It would not be possible to come to a consistent agreement because of the multiple. And we live in this multiplicity of perceptions, experiences, so-called towards ourselves, but equally so-called towards others, and towards life and situations and events. And as I say, there's no limit to that potential for what is revealed. So when in the Dharma world, we'll speak of impermanence, we'll speak of change, we often have it kind of linear, don't we? Oh, I was this person in the past, or this morning I was doing this, and now I'm listening to Christopher, and then a little while it would change to something else. Or in the course of the talk, my feelings, posture, views, power of energy and interest will change, and it's impermanent. All of which is true, relatively. But in the act of the event, just forgetting, as I say for a moment, as it were, past and futures and impermanent, there is such an inconsistency in all of this which is taking place. Incredible inconsistency. And you and I know from the way we view life, this multiplicity is taking place, there's incredible inconsistency, and in the diversity of what goes on for us, who on earth could actually come down and say, this one, this way, this is it? Because human beings will say, no, it's not. And therefore, when the understanding of this shows the emptiness of any particular view, in all the multiplicity, in all the diversity. And what human beings tend to do all too human, is to generate some other to move away from it. And we can generate it, of course, religion is generated there. And in the movement away from, or sometimes it's the ideology, sometimes it's a very strong view. And the more the identification with the view, the stronger the view. And with the strength of the view is seen to be truth. And the view, including all that's coming out of this Paul Waller's mouth, just views, the view is seen to have a very special significance. It's given its self. It's given its own importance. It's given a self-existence. And when it's got a self-existence, it's separated from all else. It seemed to be above everything else, or better than everything else. And then the view, and all that goes with the view, one thing is forgotten with the view. It doesn't have any self-existence. It can't have. It's dependently arising. First of all, it requires somebody to have it. One can't have a view out there. You know, views don't... Oh, look, there's a view just coming out of the door. The view's just... It comes. So it depends on the conditioning of the human being, on our history, on our makeup, on our state of mind, on our thoughts, on what we've inherited, of what we've been told. So there is no view which has its own existence. And sometimes we're not satisfied with it as a view. We call it the truth. The truth, more powerful. This is the truth. This is it. There is no other truth. This is the truth. There. And then we're knocking on people's doors. We've got the truth. Oh, fantastic. Show it to me. Well, I can't quite show it to you, but it's in the book. But it's a big book. There are lots of sentences. Could you just take the words out which are the truth? Can you show me? No, it's the whole truth. The whole truth is in the book. Wow. I'll have to memorize it. Because it's the truth. And but the book. What's the book? Words joined together. Some paper. Some poor trees, which were abused. I've written a few books, I can say that. So, the truth which is in the book is dependently arising. It's required someone to say, this is the truth in the book. The book doesn't say, I am the truth. The book is just paper. Some old trees that had been mushed up, and a printer had put some words. So the book doesn't have any idea this is the truth. Someone has looked at it and said, this is it. So the truth can't be in the book. How could it be? Someone has got to be conscious that it's a book, because the book has no identity. The book doesn't say, yeah, I'm a book. Believe me. And that's the same when we look at a person. This person's, you see them on the posters. This person's got the truth. Where have they got it? Where have they got it? Have they got it? Is it in the words? Which words? When they're chatting, have they got the truth? When they're giving a talk, have they got the truth? Or is it when they're silent? When they're sitting on the toilet? They're not saying anything. Would they be closer to the truth? If they are, I think we should follow them to the toilet. Etc. Some people say the truth is inexpressible. You can't use words. Words cannot express the truth. wonderful idea. It's an interesting view. Everything else is false. Everything else is a lie. Everything else is Maya. Everything else is an illusion. Everything else is false. Now we're in a real mess. Truth can't be expressed. Don't talk. You're a liar. Because you can't talk truth. You can't express it. So it's a lie. It's a fiction. It's false. It's an illusion. And therefore, there are those who say, oh, truth is inexpressible. Therefore, we can't say anything. We can't think it. Can't feel it. So, emptiness reveals the emptiness of the view. Then some will say, everybody has their own truth. It's a lovely idea. It's a New Age Waller's idea. Everybody has their own truth. You have your truth and I have my truth. And you say, well, where did this truth come from that I've got? And you haven't got it, but I've got it. You have your truth and I have my truth. And I've got my truth. But where the hell is it inside? I look inside. I meditate. I go and join one of these retreats. I close my eyes. Truth. Pop up. For God's sake, pop up. And then we have an idea. And we add something to it. And the idea that we add to it is truth. It's actually a view. But we don't want to feel it's a view. We want to feel it's truth. Yeah. So then we add that, and we might be very caring and supportive of the other person or persons. She or he, or they don't. You have your truth. So often, truth, people end up arguing. They've both got the truth. There must be millions of truths around. And when there are millions of truths around, and everybody's holding to their own truth about things, or groups are holding to it, just breeds the conflict. Truth, which we have, is no truth. It's just dependently arising. It's empty of its own existence. It's a lovely human idea for conventional purposes. Nobody has got truth. Nobody. Not in the person, not in the book, not in the view, including the view that's coming out of this poor water's mouth right now. How the extraordinary events of life are dependently arising. The view, the feeling, the idea, the language, the words, the silences, or whatever. Sometimes when we look, and we say, very strong tendency that we have. And there's a certain, to make the word stronger, it might get the point across, a certain mythology that arises. And one of the strongest mythologies that we have, which is not found in the Buddha's teachings, though sadly he is often attributed to being a supporter of the mythology, and that is cause and effect. No, Buddha doesn't teach cause and effect. And sometimes we look, and we're so conditioned in this kind of view, that we'll say, well, the reason I'm experiencing this right now, whatever it might be, is due to my childhood. So I'm the effect of my childhood. Something happened to me in my childhood, whatever it might be, beautiful or ugly, some trauma, some anguish, some pain, or whatever, it's difficult. And because of that which happened to me, now I am the effect of it. If the cause is there, that's the cause, that causes, that experience causes that. It makes me like I am. And that's in the cause in there. Then presumably, everybody who has that similar kind of experience will have to experience a similar effect. There'd be no escape. It caused it. It is responsible for how I am. And that movement from the past, the view, seems to have landed in the present, and now I'm feeling this because of that. There. But if one actually goes to the event with the recollections, that's good psychotherapy and reflection analysis will do. What is in that event that is a cause? What is in it which is the cause? Can you find the cause in the event, in what happened? And you look and say, well, this happened, and 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 this, and this, and this person did this, and this person said this, and this person did this to me, and this person did that to me, and it was in this place, and this time, etc. I look in every little, all of that, and pack it all. Can you find anything which is the cause for this? Anything in it? You can't. It's a contemporary myth of cause and effect. Because if so, point to it. Show me the cause. One day, we'll grow out of this thinking. I remember in California, I never thought, because California, you know, psychotherapists, they grow on trees. And I wrote them there when I was giving a retreat at Spirit Rock. And I know Jack Cornfield came here last year, and much appreciation for that. So I was at the Spirit Rock Center. So because there's so many therapists and analysts and body workers and mind-body workers, so I wrote a little note, because you send the title of your retreat, then you send a few lines, a little description, and then at the end of it, I put, please do not bring your inner child, because there is no adult supervision. And I didn't think it would get past the Spirit Rock censors. But to their credit, on to them. They actually included it. They left it in there. The gratitude from me was overwhelming. So sometimes we have an assumption. This caused me to be like this. It's not found in it, though. And sometimes you say, well, if it's not found in it, why am I like this? Why am I experiencing this? Dependently arising. If there were no conditions, it couldn't arise. If there are no conditions, it couldn't arise. But the conditions are infinite. The conditions are multiple. And the multiplicity of the conditions bring it about. Yet we're fixed. We have a belief system. As much as the orthodoxies of cause and effect. And it just goes unexamined, because if it was the cause, as I said earlier, everybody would have to experience the same effect, because it's a cause. Not the case. Lots of people have very difficult experiences. I've listened to many, many stories, thousands over the years, who people have gone through incredible dramas and traumas and crises at all sorts of levels, and have emerged out of those events which were dependently arising, and have emerged out of them, and there's no whisper of any cause in it, no signal. It just wasn't having that kind of view and carry on flow. And then sometimes in life, one of the great teachers of greatest of all teachers of emptiness, and the greatest commentator on the Buddha's teachings is Nagarjuna, and he lived several centuries later. And he keeps pointing out, keeps exploring, even with back to the roles and identities. The view that we have often goes unexamined, and one can use the father and the son view. And it's just a way of looking. And there's a small example of what I mean. A normal mind will say, the father comes before the son. The father comes before the son. How can there be a father without a son? If there was a father without a son, then he was a father when he was a little boy. Because the father doesn't need the son. So how could the father come before the son? And if we go the other way, and we say, well, there was, when the son came, then there was the father. Well, that would be breathtaking, wouldn't it? We could all be a son and not have a father. I mean, I know something happened in Bethlehem 2,000 years ago, but it's not very often. Excuse that. And so how could there be a son without a father? It means that sons could appear. I appear. I don't need a father. And if the two arose together, it just, the father and the son just came together. When one couldn't cause the other, they just arose. It's amazing. So whatever view we take, father can't come before the son, because it means he was a father when he was born. Son can't come before the father, it means the son doesn't need a father to be born. And they can't come, just appear miraculously both at the same time. It's just an agreement. It's just a way of thinking. Even the common sense way of thinking. It just reveals the emptiness of the view. That's all. And the inquiry, the exploration of all of this is not that you and I suppress our views. My goodness me, I'm sitting up here spouting them on. Some people may be unfortunate to look on the website and hear the views or listen to this, or even worse, watch it. And get the views pouring out. Somebody said to me, in India, Christopher, you have a lot of views about everything. I said, I don't when I'm not talking. That's the break. So the understanding of emptiness is not in some transcendent, beyond other, out there to get to. Because if it was, then we'd have the words, we'd have the language, have the views, and then we'd be saying, look, the emptiness. you know, what the Buddha speaks about. That's out there somewhere. Or it's behind the words. Or it's beyond the words. Or it's in the words. We love it. It's either got to be above, behind, below, or within. Then we can have a really good argument. Is emptiness above, below, behind, or within? And then we have views about that. The views, the perceptions, the multiplicity, the infinity of things, everyone, it only confirms the emptiness of the view. Meaning it doesn't have its own inherent self-existence. There is no truth. There is no view which is the absolutely right view. It's the view. And Dharma teachings is not to push us all into a state of silence. It recognizes and acknowledges our sharing, our communication, our language, our expressions, but just understand the emptiness of it. That's all. Whatever. And then we don't have this, oh, is it beyond, is it inside, is it deeper than, I'm not going deep enough, whatever. More views and views. So in the multiplicity, in the sheer diversity, whether our experience is shallow, superficial, mind is chattering away, 19 to the dozen, we can't make up our mind about anything. And whether it's so deep, really deep, concentrated, like those Zen masters, etc. And it's really, you know, down there in the depth of something. Whatever. It also is inconsistent. Have you ever met anybody who's constantly in the deep? Constantly there? These, you know, there might be some people, I've never met them, not even in the monastery, and there's, God, there were some eccentrics in the monastery. But even in the depth, it changes, it shifts, it moves around. It's inconsistent. We live in this extraordinary multiplicity. We're always looking for the answer. And it's not that, as I said, we're resorting to a silence. But perhaps, in waking up, perhaps, in really the meetings with all of this, that the multiplicity, the diversity, the transience of it all, the views that go with it, all the different ways that you and I can look at what's out there and look at what's in here, all of it is the confirmation that none of it has any self to it. It's empty of any selfness. It's all dependently arising. And there is nothing, and I'm going to repeat till the cows come home here. There is nothing whatsoever which is not dependently arising. Nothing. Not your life, not my life, not this planet, not this galaxy, not this universe, not this, not that. There is not one thing, not one idea, not one experience, not one thought, not one consciousness, not one event which is not dependently arising. It's a relief. Just dependently arising. It's a relief. And sometimes we're getting old. Well, some of you aren't, but getting old. The passage of the years is going by. And when we grab some feature of the process and hold on to it, in the moment of holding on to it, we fail to see its dependent arising. And we think the problem is in the changes that are going on. Not. So sometimes as we get older, the view will arise, God, I'm aging. I'm getting older, I'm aging. And then someone says, oh, Christopher, you don't look 64. You only look 62. Great, wonderful, made my day, that's so good. I knew I'm not as old as I look. Whatever. And then sometimes we look, and we look at parts of the body, the left leg, I notice with my left leg. It's slow to get out of the posture. I see sometimes I look around, people have been sitting for an hour. They might have been having a latte, let's get up and walk out. It'd be 10 minutes later, leg is still moving, getting that knee moving, or whatever. I long since realized parts of the body doesn't age together. Some of it's in really working good order. But this left leg is at least 77 years old. And the right leg's about 59. It's not fair. So when we grab, when we hold on and say, oh, I'm aging, we think that's really something, or I'm sick. It's really something. And once we've grabbed the aging, and once we've grabbed the sickness, and once we have given it self-existence. We've impressed a lot onto it. And when we've given it self-existence, we fail to see it is dependently arising. Multiple conditions bring about the events. And if that's clear, the anxieties and the fears and the worries, in this case about aging, will begin to drop away because we understand something in another way. And the teachings are saying to us again and again, see the emptiness of clinging to something as having a self-existence. Be completely clear about dependent arising. And you know something? It's very hard to refute it. Understand the word? It's very hard to dismiss it. To dismiss the perception, to dismiss the view. Because you can't, and I can't, show anything in this world which is not dependently arising. If you could, it means it would not be affected by anything. Nothing. If it was not dependently arising, it would mean that it would be absolutely permanent. Because nothing could affect it. But there's nothing other than dependent arising. And when we understand that, and even when we look into it, we say, oh, I'll take myself around, I walk in here, and then I begin to ramble on there. And in that which is being spoken and being said, it's not just coming from this myself. It's not just coming from myself. If I could create this, called the words, the views, etc., then it would just keep going. If I had some self-existence and it didn't require dependent arising, totally independent of everything, and what comes has got nothing to do with anything else, it would just keep coming out. I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop. Just go on, because it doesn't need anything. It doesn't need any energy, doesn't need any support, doesn't need any encouragement, doesn't need any present, it doesn't need any body. The voice would just go on and on and on. And I've said a few times, people said, Christopher, I've listened to so many of your talks over the years. And I always say, Do you know how many I've listened to? I've listened to them all. Every day at 4 o'clock. I'm surprised at home I just don't go into the cross-legged posture and start giving a talk to the empty kitchen. It's a phenomenon that we live in. So nothing can independently arise. It's in this vast field of dependently arising conditions, all of it. And if I can get a sense of that and explore that, then I'll be less grasping onto the aging, because I see the conditions for aging are environmental impact. For sure, the environment had its impact on me, then my hair wouldn't go white, and I'd stay nice and young, I wouldn't need any food, etc. I wouldn't require any air. So the environmental influence is having an aging. The inner life is having aging. There's genetic factors having aging. The biology is contributing to aging. The nature is contributing to it. The way people have treated me is contributing to it. Now look at aging, and I see it doesn't have its own existence. It's just dependently arising. And it's empty of being something. And I can't actually say, what is the aging? Is it the crow's feet? Well, I had them years ago. Whatever. Is it white hair? Is that aging? Well, if it is, I think I'll go and change the colour. I'll make it brown, like some of you have done. No names mentioned. I'm a very polite Englishman. Whatever. Then I'll stop aging because I've got a different colour. So it's not the white. So when we look to anything, we say, wow, it doesn't have its own existence. There's no such thing as aging. It's empty of it. There's no such thing as the Father. There's no such thing as the cause. And human beings are spellbound with fathers and mothers and causes and aging. And the Buddha says, look at all of this. It's empty of it. And the confirmation of the emptiness of it is the dependent arising. As I said, it is it wouldn't be easy for a human being to dismiss the inquiry. The relinquishment of the views, that means the letting go, the non-holding. That even the view to finish that has been expressed in, shall we call it, the sequence of sentences over the last 45 minutes or so, is not having its own true existence of itself. Why? It is dependently arising. May all beings live with awareness. May all beings engage in the immediacy of inquiry. May all beings be liberated to explore the multiplicity of everything.